Welcome to The Signal. I'm Abby Trevino.
And I'm Madeline Bizzo. We're with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. Happy Lunar New Year. But this year, it's a celebration that's plagued by a new virus.
When you don't feel it through until you saw the doctor try to protect themselves and dress like this, you suddenly feel like this is a movie.
We'll hear from Chinese students in Halifax about their worries for friends and families back home.
Also today on the show, how climate change might affect our winters in the future.
What we're finding is that, yes, the rain snow line is moving gradually northward, more occurrence of freezing rain, and the challenges that come with that.
And how global warming can contribute to the spread of Lyme disease in the province.
Actually, all of Nova Scotia now is considered at risk.
Plus, later, the building that produced This Hour Has 22 Minutes is being torn down this spring.
That building, the CBC, that housed CBC Halifax, it always punched above its weight.
We'll hear stories from the old CBC TV building on Bell Road. All that and more on today's show.
Around the world, people and governments are worrying about the potential spread of a new coronavirus. In China, where it originated, the government is restricting travel in and out of some cities in an attempt to contain the virus. Here in Halifax, hospitals are doing extra screening for people with flu-like symptoms. The city has a large population of Chinese students, some of whom recently traveled to China over the holidays. And many of those students are now worrying about families back home. I spoke to some of them and have this report. Colin Sun is a fourth-year commerce student at St. Mary's University. She's watching a video taken inside a Chinese hospital with a mix of shock and disbelief. She's from Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak.
I played games like before, like, you know, the kind of game, like use kind of bacteria to attack the whole world. I never saw it really happen to myself. I still feel fictional, non-realistic.
Normally, at this time of year, her social media feed and family group chat would be filled with well wishes for the Chinese New Year. Instead, they're flooded with advice on which herbs and medicines best protect against the coronavirus and which stores still have face masks in stock. Sun's parents have canceled travel plans to get together with family for Chinese New Year. Thousands of kilometers away, Colin can't help but worry.
But I still feel a little bit useless.
Students at Dalhousie campus say they're concerned about the spread of the disease, but most don't think it will reach here, with one exception.
Because it's really widespread in China, and it's really dangerous, so actually I'm very concerned about it here. So actually I just buy some mask yesterday evening from Amazon, yeah.
Dr. Todd Hatchett is a director of virology and immunology at the QE2 hospital in Halifax. He says the SARS and H1N1 outbreaks have given health centers better protocols for identifying the virus, if it makes an appearance.
It's possible with people moving around with the Chinese New Year coming, and that's why we want to make sure that people are aware not only to help healthcare workers identify and ask the right questions, but also educate the public to make sure that if they have traveled to an area that is at risk, that they identify that they have been there if they present with signs of a respiratory infection when they come home.
Still, Hatchett says he's more worried about the regular seasonal flu, which is ramping up now.
Thanks, Abby. Chinese health officials said today at least 26 people have died from the virus. They're reporting 830 cases in total, a sharp increase from yesterday. So far, the World Health Organization has decided not to declare a global health emergency.
Our colleague Jacob Postlewaite has popped by from the video workshop. He's doing a story on Dry January. So Jacob, what is Dry January?
So Dry January is a public health campaign that started in the UK in 2013 by a group called Alcohol Concern. And what it is it's a campaign to get you thinking about your own alcohol habits, especially after the holidays. So they chose January as a month to give you a chance to sort of take a break from drinking and reassess your relationship to alcohol.
And are there any resources to help you stay sober?
So there's actually a brand new resource that just came out at the beginning of this year. It's a website called Sober City, and it lists a bunch of tips for people that want to give sobriety a try or are thinking about it. And it was started by a woman named Leanne Richardson, who is a recovered alcoholic. She's 6 years sober, and she wanted to start the website because she feels that Halifax really is a city that has a lot of drinking culture here, and she wanted to make something for people that wanted to give sobriety a try. So here she is talking about her feelings on Dry January.
You'll start to sleep better. That's one of the immediate things you find. Anxiety can get a lot better. And it forces you to be creative about other things you might want to do other than the usual drinking. So overall, it's amazing.
What are some of her tips to stay sober?
So three of her biggest tips to stay sober are first to set some personal goals. Maybe you want to go back to the gym and drop 10 pounds, or if you'd like to, say, clean your apartment, maybe one room at a time, just set a personal goal, something you can work towards. She also recommends that you attend a regular meeting, not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but a meeting, something that is scheduled every week to just have a regular time for you to go out and meet with people. And another one of her big tips is to follow your interests. If you maybe have a passing interest in, painting, it'd be good to just follow that and get into some painting. Or if you wanted to try playing basketball for a while, maybe good to start getting into that. So just to follow your interests.
So this isn't something that's strictly for alcoholics?
No, this is really a campaign for everybody. And if somebody was dealing with alcohol addiction, it's probably best to talk to your healthcare provider before giving Dry January a try.
Great. Thanks so much, Jacob. That was our colleague from the video workshop who popped by to tell us about Dry January. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We hear a lot about global warming, and yet we've got lots of snow and ice on the ground right now. We were wondering whether a warming climate will change that. Our reporter, Lucia Hedler, did some digging and discovered that for people in Halifax, winter may get a whole lot icier.
It was one of those classic old buildings in Halifax with the uneven steps, and because they were so icy, there was really no way to avoid it.
Bree Dukeshire slipped on some icy steps last year and broke her foot.
I was pretty devastated. I'm a runner, so I knew that it was going to be taking away one of my favorite hobbies for a good amount of time, and the recovery process was very long. I was in the cast for 6 months and then still on crutches after that. And then I had to do physiotherapy for another 5 months before I was able to run, and I'm just starting to get back into it now.
The Canadian Institute of Health Information says during the winter of 2016-17, almost 9,000 people were injured by falling on ice in Canada. Dr. Kirk McGee is an emergency room doctor at the QE2 hospital. He treats lots of folks who fall on the ice.
So from slip and falls, probably the biggest thing you see are either wrist injuries or ankle injuries. Fractured wrists, fractured sprained ankles. But occasionally you'll see someone that comes in with a significant head injury from a fall.
And he may see more patients in the years to come. Meteorologist Gary Lyons says climate change is making for icier winters in Nova Scotia.
So we are getting into a pattern where there will be more rain than snow, and a more frequent occurrence of freezing rain goes along with that. And it also does not discount the fact that we will still get heavy snows, because overall we're going to get more precipitation. So whether it's rain or snow, there's going to be more of it. And what we're finding is that, yes, the rain-snow line is moving gradually northward, more occurrence of freezing rain, and the challenges that come with that.
Environment Canada's senior climatologist David Phillips agrees. The weather is changing.
It won't be new weather. It'll be the same weather as our grandparents had to deal with. But in fact, what will change is the severity, the extremes, the duration, out of season, out of place. Something that would be rare would now be more common.
Just like the snowstorm that buried Newfoundland last weekend. For The Signal, I'm Lucia Helder.
Climate warming is also expected to have an effect on our health. You might think you're safe from ticks in the winter, but ticks can survive all year round if winters are mild enough. And with ticks comes a risk of disease. Maddie talked to one woman who's worried about that.
Donna Lugar has felt the flu-like symptoms of Lyme disease for more than a decade. The Bedford woman was finally diagnosed in 2011.
Sometimes if you have just minor flu-like symptoms, you don't really think about it as being a tick bite. I live in an endemic community. My cottage is in an endemic community. Actually, all of Nova Scotia now is considered at risk.
Now, Lugar is a Nova Scotia representative of the Canadian Lyme Disease Foundation. She's also founder of the Nova Scotia Lyme Support Group and advises the Lunenburg Lyme Association.
The majority of people I speak to, hundreds, never saw the tick, never saw the bite. They can't get a diagnosis. Doctors are telling them it's all in their head.
Another problem? Thinking you're safe from ticks in the winter. Lugar says people contact her saying they found ticks on their dogs in January.
Climate change certainly helps to spread them and make them stay alive.
Colleen Ryan specializes in control of communicable diseases at the Provincial Department of Health and Wellness. She says the number of Lyme cases varies from year to year.
In general, the number of reported cases has been on the rise.
Ryan says Nova Scotia is preparing for the effects of climate change. It's part of a federally funded climate adaptation program.
Among a broad range of factors with warming temperatures, we anticipate an increase in illness carried by ticks or mosquitoes, so vector-borne diseases, as these populations spread over a broader geographic range.
As well as Lyme disease, ticks could carry anaplasmosis, normally found in southern U.S. And there have been outbreaks of West Nile diseases in Canada, spread by infected mosquitoes. Ryan says people can protect themselves by checking for ticks after being in the woods and wearing bug spray with DEET.
That's really interesting, Maddie. I didn't think ticks were out in the winter.
Yeah, you always have to be careful.
You're listening to The Signal, stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College of School of Journalism. I'm Abby Trevino.
And I'm Madeline Bizzo. Still to come on the show. Iranians working or studying in Halifax look for ways to remember the victims of the bombing of the Ukrainian flight.
We're just trying to keep their names alive here and don't forget them never ever.
And a building that's been an important part of the media and cultural life in Halifax is coming down.
That building is haunted. It's haunted by Canadian culture. It's haunted with, the spirit of Don Messer.
We'll hear from someone who spent a lot of time at the Bell Road CBC building.
And how postcards from the past can help us understand our city today.
You can see sort of the transformation of the city through buildings that no longer exist.
Iranian people in Halifax continue to mourn those lost in the Ukrainian Airlines bombing earlier this month. Now, members of the Dalhousie Iranian Student Society are raising funds for a bursary in honor of the January 8th plane crash victims. Chelsea Clarew has more.
The Dalhousie Iranian Student Society held a vigil Wednesday night in honor of the five victims who are working or studying in Halifax. This second vigil focused on including the rest of the Halifax community and raising money for the Iranian Memorial Bursary Fund. Neda Alizada said this was a project she and a friend thought about on the night of the crash.
I was so sad, but I didn't know, I was just thinking that what should I do? And if it was me, what would I wanted people to do for me? And then I was talking to Masa, I wish we could do something, because we're students and we can help the students, so we can, if it was happening to me, Masa, maybe you would do a scholarship, fundraising for a scholarship.
The money will be used to help Iranian students in financial need.
I'm glad that Dalhousie supported us for such opportunity so we can keep this scholarship with their names forever at Dalhousie University, which I think it's good for the history to just not forgetting what happened to some innocent people who were ordinary people in academics and they're now gone.
Dalhousie University has already donated $25,000. The Iranian Student Society is hoping to raise double that amount. They've currently raised $4,000. Neda's friend, Masa Majidi, says it's about more than just raising money and helping Iranian students fulfill their dream.
We're just trying to keep their names alive here and don't forget them never, ever.
You can find more information about the Iranian Memorial Bursary Fund at projectdal.ca. For The Signal, I'm Chelsea Clarew. Hi.
you commute downtown, chances are you've driven past the CBC building on Bell Road many times. That will change this spring. The Nova Scotia government has issued a tender to demolish it to make a way for expansion of the infirmary hospital next door. Jeff Dion worked in the TV building for many years. He joins us in studio. Hi, Jeff. How does it feel to hear that building's coming down?
To be honest, I'm a little bit emotional about it. I spent a lot of time in that building. I worked for 22 years in that building. And, you know, when you spend that long at a workplace, you can't help but absorb the culture of it. And I was really interested in the history of that building in the time I was there. I think more so than a lot of other people who worked there. For a lot of people, it was just a workplace. For me, it was a cultural epicenter. Like, I'm a student of Canadian culture, and the CBC building on Bell Road is a sort of a petri dish. A lot of amazing things were done in that building. You know, as Canadians learned how to make television in the 1950s, CBC Halifax was a big part of the experimentation, and a lot of things were figured out in CBC Halifax. That building, the CBC that housed CBC Halifax, it always punched above its weight. You know, the broadcast centers in Canada were Toronto and Montreal, and still are. But there was this place on Bell Road in Halifax which punched out an incredible amount of programming, network programming, which was phenomenally successful. And for some time I got really interested in, and I looked at all of the television shows that were ever produced at CBC Halifax, and because they're in the archives, and you can watch them on film. I steeped myself in it, and I came away completely amazed at how innovative and creative the producers and journalists at CBC Halifax were. And it all happened in that building. So when it comes down, a piece of Nova Scotia history, a piece of Canadian broadcast history is coming down with it.
Mm-hmm. For example, what shows came out of the building?
Oh, there's a long list. I mean, just to pick on the highlights, there was a show came out of Bell Road starting in 1957, which went on to become the most watched television show in Canada. At one point, it had higher ratings than Hockey Night in Canada. It was called Don Messer's Jubilee. It was a musical show, and it was an old-time sort of fiddling thing. Don Messer was like a fiddle player from Prince Edward Island, and it started in 1957. By 1959, 1960, it was one of the most popular shows on Canadian television. It was on a Monday night, and everybody watched it across the country. It's hard to think of an equivalent today. It would be, because, you know, the broadcast industry is so fragmented, but maybe it's like Super Bowl. I mean, it's that big. Everybody in the country would watch Don Messer's Jubilee. And that spawned another show called Sing Along Jubilee. And some very famous people went through Sing Along Jubilee. It was a folk music kind of program. Anne Murray was discovered on that show. Gordon Lightfoot played on that show. A whole bunch of really famous Canadian musicians went through that show. So I'd say Don Messer and Sing Along Jubilee are the two highest profile shows that came through there. But there was also journalism shows went through there. The McIntyre File. You've probably heard of Lyndon McIntyre. Very famous Canadian journalist, now an author, was one of the hosts of The Fifth Estate. He cut his television journalism teeth at the CBC Halifax on his show called The McIntyre File. Other prominent journalists have been through that building. The current host of The National, Ian Hanuman Singh, went through that building. The current host of the radio, The News at Six, comes out of Toronto on CBC, Susan Bonner, went through that building. The current senior political reporter for the CBC, Susan Ormiston,
wow,
now based in Washington, went through that building. So it's got a really strong tradition of journalism through that building. But it has, in addition to that, it has an incredible record as a performance space. This tiny little studio in that building spawned incredible programs, one of which is still on the air, I think now in its 27th season, called This Hour is 22 Minutes.
What's some of your favorite stories that came out of the building?
My favorite memories of Bell Road were at the 22 Minutes tapings on a Friday night. where we would jam 90 people into that little tiny studio that I talked about. And when I say jammed in, I mean cheek to jowl. People were literally, you know, when they were where they were sitting, they would literally be 2 feet from a camera operator, and they might be 10 feet from Kathy Jones or Mary Walsh or Rick Mercer or Greg Toomey. It was packed in there. And, you know, we'd run the content. We'd either run the news stories that I'd cut that week, or they'd run sketches, and you got instant feedback. And so my favorite memory of that building is standing underneath the bleachers at the back of the room, because that's just, you know, it was so packed. That was the only place I could stand. And standing back and listening to the audience reaction of This Hour is 22 Minutes on any given week. And it's incredibly satisfying to get instant feedback on programming that you've just worked on, as opposed to news programming, which is, you know, sometimes you don't get any reaction to it. They were good times. I used to love those Friday nights, and I look back on them with great fondness.
Will you be watching when the building comes down?
I will, probably. I mean, it won't be a pilgrimage or anything. I'm not going to camp out. But I watched the CBC radio building come down and photographed and videotaped that and did the tour of that building 3 days before the Records Ball went through, and took a whole bunch of photographs of the inside of that building. I will make a point of going back to Bell Road before it comes down. I plan to attend the last taping of This Hour is 22 Minutes. That building is haunted, and I mean in a good way. It's haunted by Canadian culture. It's haunted with, you know, the spirit of Don Messer walks in that building. Every time we did a music show in the new studio, I was always aware that 80 feet down the corridor, there was this tiny little studio in which the greatest, most popular Canadian variety show ever was produced. And it was kind of inspirational, you know, to do variety programming 80 feet away from that room in the new big room. I think that, you know, there ought to be a blue plaque in the new hospital building that says, on this site stood CBHT, and tell a little bit of the story of that building. It's got a rich history with a lot of successes to its name.
Thank you so much for telling that story. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
That was Jeff Dion. He worked for 22 years at the CBC building on Bell Road. It's being torn down this spring to make room for the expansion of the Queen Elizabeth Health Sciences Center, which is located next door.
Well, just down the way from Bell Road, the Halifax band, the Town Heroes, are playing tonight at the Seahorse. That's on Gottingen Street. The indie alt rock band launched a new album in 2018. Here's a tune from that, called On Paper.
That I'd rather leave alone to the safety of my mind. Mind, you know you can't read it. I'll give you clues. One, nothing is the way that I thought it would be. Two different people tell me to change. I'm living with the white noise, taking all the wrong choices.
Here's why I love you.
are the town heroes with On Paper, from the album Everything Will Be Fine When We Get to Where We Think We're Going. Yes, that's the title, and I ain't saying it twice. You can catch them tonight at the Seahorse Tavern. Tickets are $15, plus those nasty fees. Doors open at 9.
I don't know whether the CBC TV building we heard about has ever been commemorated in a postcard, but lots of other recognizable buildings and places around the city have been. In fact, there are two collections of postcards many people might not know about. Amy Briley has the details.
The Central Library is uncovering some little-known Halifax history in an unconventional way, through old postcards. Today's postcards often depict a place's most prominent scenes. But librarian Joanne McCarthy O'Leary says the older ones do so much more.
These are great quick mini sources where you can see the transformation of the city through buildings that no longer exist or streetscapes that no longer exist.
The library recently added about 70 new postcards to its 400-piece collection. These cards depict people, places, and events in the municipality from the early 1900s to the 80s. Amy McDonald was responsible for digitizing this latest batch.
What I loved maybe the most was just seeing that in every decade or in every sort of era in Halifax, community is really strong, and a lot of the photographs sort of reflect that. And in that sense, things change over time, but then some things don't change, and that's what history can teach us.
McDonald says she's learned countless things about the city's history and the people in it through the personal notes between lovers, family, and friends. The Nova Scotia Archives also has an extensive collection of postcards from all across the province. Gary Schutluck is an archivist there. He says people once sent postcards often. They were cheaper than sending a package or letter. In this way, a collection of postcards provides a compelling snapshot of moments in Nova Scotia's history.
So that makes them important, because sometimes the only place you will see that event, that person, or that place is on a postcard. I mean, there are many postcards we have of buildings. We have no photographs of them. The only way we have an image of them is because we have a lithographic postcard.
McCarthy O'Leary and McDonald say sometimes it's the stranger postcards that tell us the most about life in the city.
There's a photo of 9 lobsters, red lobsters, all on display, each playing a different instrument at the Seashell Seafood Restaurant.
You wouldn't really see a postcard like that today, or it would be odd if you did, maybe.
Both the library and the Nova Scotia Archives say they welcome people to check out their collections, in person or online. For The Signal, I'm Amy Brierley.
Well, that's our show for today.
If there's anything you want to hear again, you can find a link on our social media feeds. Our handle is SignalHFX on Twitter and Instagram.
And we'd love to hear from you if you have any thoughts on the show.
Thanks this week to producer Lucia Helder and associate producer Dominic Amit. Amy Brierley and Chelsea Clarew were our digital producers.
A shout out to our technician, Mark Pinio, in the control room.
And our audio professor extraordinaire, Pauline Dakin. We'll be back next week with more stories. Have a great weekend.